listening to Football in Europe, the weekly podcast covering the game across the continent.
Hello, it's Rob from Football in Europe. Your latest edition of the podcast is going to be out 24 hours later than usual, so November the 29th. We'll be looking ahead to next weekend's Clásico between Barcelona and Real Madrid. Plus, we'll have all the major stories, including an update on Henrik Larsson's situation with hooligans in Sweden, RB Leipzig's seven-game winning run continuing to stay top in Germany, and why Monaco are just looking so good at the moment in France, having beaten Spurs in the Champions League. But to see you through to the next show, we've got a mini bonus show here, about 20 minutes, and it's an interview with Stephen G. Mandis. Now, he's just released a book called The Real Madrid Way, How Values Created the Most Successful Sports Team on the Planet. And it is a true behind-the-scenes look at everything at Real Madrid. And Florentino Perez, the club president, gave Stephen complete access to everything in terms of finances, data, lots of things. And Stephen himself, who didn't even know who Raul was when he started the project, admits he couldn't believe just how much he was shown, and some of the results are absolutely fascinating. For reference, Stephen told me prior to the interview that Sir Alex Ferguson, so compelled having read Stephen's book, wrote him a four-page letter to discuss some of the content. And Billy Beane of Moneyball fame at the Oakland Athletics, along with Ferguson, has endorsed the book as well. And Beane, in fact, so taken by Stephen's account of Real Madrid, has changed the way two things at the club, at Oakland Athletics, his baseball team, he's changed how they work based on what he read in this book. So really interesting stuff from Stephen. We get on to why Real Madrid spend their money the way they do, injury policy, why they change managers so often, and Stephen provides some fascinating insight. But we start with Atletico, actually, Real Madrid's rivals. And because we were just chatting about why have Atletico changed their playing style this season. They're trying to be a little bit more entertaining to watch, but then it's not proving as fruitful for them domestically. They've been so successful playing their brand of football under Simeone, reaching two Champions Leagues in recent years. So this is how our chat with Stephen G. Mandis got underway.
This is Football in Europe special interview.
What Atletico has realized, that they don't really generate a lot of fans and excitement by playing Simeone's defensive way. And I think that that's because you can do it in the country setting because people will get behind it. But when you're trying to really compete for fans, and it's really competitive, right? Are you going to be a Man U fan or a Real Madrid fan or whatever? People don't really want to be an Atletico fan globally because it's not exciting to watch when they just play defense. It's because it doesn't generate money.
Yeah.
It doesn't make them money. And for a club, for a country team, it doesn't matter because you're going to support support England and come out of high water or whatever it is. They don't care how they play as long as they win. But when you can turn on the TV and watch Man U or Real Madrid or Atletico, the last one's going to watch Atletico. So you're like, I don't know, it'll be 0-0 or, you know, Griezmann will score one goal at the very end. Where Real Madrid, you're like, I don't know, these guys could score seven and let four in. This is what I say in the book. You cannot look at what's going on the pitch without understanding what's going on off the pitch because it dictates what's going on the pitch. That's what people miss with Florentino. It's like to criticize Florentino for hiring David Beckham and say, oh, he throws off the balance and all this other stuff. Well, David Beckham is what really paid for, you know, Zidane and Figo. So yeah, they have to have some. It has to be in the equation somehow. And as I described in the book, people said, oh, the reason that they failed was because of Makaleli. They got rid of Makaleli, and I have the data in there to show they were no better or worse with or without Makaleli. The problem was age.
Stephen, your book talks about the values that have made Real Madrid so successful. How does that play into the appointment of managers in recent years? And I'm even thinking back to when they went for Mourinho and then moved on to Ancelotti and Benitez. What is the policy in your view?
Mourinho's hiring was in part driven by the fact that there was this pressure of Barcelona's success. And when there's pressure like that, that may cause management to make, you know, decisions that are inconsistent with the true values. It'll cause them to drift. He's obviously a very successful coach. I think some other things that he did bring in were some discipline and discipline in training and some other, and modernize a lot of the aspects of the club. But I think at the end of the day, when I interviewed most socios or members, they did feel like it was some sort of deviation in terms of his attitude and behavior. And I do think that that then set up the hiring of Ancelotti. Ancelotti has the characteristics that are very important for what I believe are very important for a Real Madrid coach, which are that they're an elite player. They have had success as a manager, if possible, but also have a calm personality. So if you look at Munoz and you look at De Bosque and Ancelotti, they've had success with these elite players. And as we talked about before, Ancelotti just didn't incorporate enough of the youth players and embrace the idea of rotations. But already 2 or 3 years ago, when I started the project, already there were people talking about Zidane and the fact that he was being groomed to become the next coach because of the characteristics I said. He was an elite player. He knew Real Madrid. He would have the respect of the players. He's a calm personality. So they knew he had all the traits. They just wanted to make sure that he didn't come in and struggle. So they wanted to make sure he had as much preparation as possible. And Benitez, I think, was a little bit like Mourinho in that he had good training discipline. He understood the importance of rotations, and he understood the academy being an academy, a product of the academy. In many ways, to me, Benitez was, in preparation of Zidane, getting the team ready for Zidane, probably like how Mourinho was getting a team ready for Ancelotti to have success. I mean, Ancelotti would not have had the success, I don't think, without a little bit of the things Mourinho did. And Zidane did a lot of actually the same things that Benitez did, but he installed them, and I think and Zidane benefited from them and accelerated some things and enhanced some things. But there's no question Benitez was helpful to the team.
I mean, Perez, obviously, Stephen, does have a reputation for changing his coaches a lot. From your look at the numbers, has this been harmful to their chances of success?
People believe that Florentino changes coaches too much or too regularly, which I do discuss the impact of changing coaches. But if you look at the numbers of Real Madrid versus Barcelona versus Atletico versus Chelsea or whatever, Real Madrid changes coaches as often as they all do. So I think they all had double-digit coaching changes since 2000. So it was like 10-plus for all those clubs. And then even if you look at Manchester United, look how quickly since Sir Alex Ferguson, there's been many, many coaching changes. And then the other thing I did look into is people said that, you know, once again, Florentino changes too many times. When I looked back at Real Madrid's history, when they had won 5 European Cups from 1955 to 1960, they had 6 coaching changes during those 5 years. And the other surprising fact was that Real Madrid has only had 2 coaches who've coached for 4 seasons or more, which are Munoz, who obviously coached for a long time and was a former player, and Del Bosque, who was a former player and had won the European Cup or Champions League, just like how Munoz did. And so here you are with Zidane. So you'll see a lot of parallels. There's a lot of parallels if you start looking at Di Stefano and Bernabeu. You see Ronaldo and Perez. You see Munoz. You see Zidane. So you're starting to see some parallels. You had Puskas with Di Stefano in the 1950s. You kind of have Bale with Ronaldo now. So there very much is a focus on trying to essentially modernize what was the strategy in the 1950s, where Real Madrid had success. And that's what the socios wanted, is to go back to that heritage of winning with these great players and things like that. And I think they learned a lot of things that were in 1955 actually still work today.
Can you just tell us a little bit about the Real Madrid way and why you wrote it?
I happened to meet the management team by chance. In the back of my mind was the book and movie Moneyball, which explained the importance of data analytics in success on the field or on the pitch. And so when I asked one of the top executives what was the key to success, was it money, was it talent, was it data analytics? And him being a former engineer and somebody very familiar with financial topics, I thought, of course, he was going to tell me all about data analytics. And instead, he started telling me that values and culture are the most important thing. And then as I got further into it and learned that the club actually was very close to bankruptcy in 2000 when they took over, and then they revived it, obviously, to being the most valuable sports team in the world with the most revenues, I just thought it was a fascinating story. So I asked them, even though I had no experience in sports or European football, and I'm not a fan of Real Madrid, I don't speak Spanish, out of intellectual curiosity, I said, do you mind if I do a study of Real Madrid, an actual academic rigorous study where they'd have to give me all the information, financial information, data on the players, etc. And I couldn't believe it when they said yes.
So did they just open the door and basically give you access to pretty much anything you wanted?
Yes, they've given me complete access to anyone in the organization that I wanted to, or people outside the organization if I needed an introduction. So I saw all the financial information, much of which is actually published in a report that they provide their members. And then all the data and analytics, access to players, coaches, former players, etc. So I think people were shocked at the amount of transparency that they were providing an outsider. Actually, one of the people who read the book, who provided an endorsement quote, told me that they thought it was crazy that they would give an outsider this much access and information. And they thought it was even more crazy that they would allow me to publish it, because obviously it has a lot of confidential proprietary information. But if you really understand the management team, they believe that transparency is a cornerstone of their values. And with transparency comes trust, and trust is an important part of the brand of Real Madrid for them.
I think I saw the quote that somewhere that you labeled Real Madrid as the most successful sports team or sports franchise in the world. How do you quantify that? How do you come to that idea?
That's a good question. So I guess two ways. One is they won the most trophies in the world. That's an indisputable fact. I think over 100 trophies, but they've won 11 Champions Leagues, and then they won 32 La Ligas, so those are indisputable facts. Mm-hmm. That they've just won the most trophies. And then off the field, they're the most valuable sports team in the world. That's not just validated by various magazines. I actually spoke to mergers and acquisitions experts in the sports field. And then they have the most, which is indisputable, most revenues of any sports team. And then what makes European football teams very unique as compared to American sports teams is you do not need approval to buy a European football club. So that allows anyone to buy it. Where in the States, there's all types of restrictions as to who can buy and what entities and things like that. So that's obviously gives them a tremendous advantage in terms of potential buyers.
Now, you mentioned Moneyball at the start of this interview, and that's, I've read that book three times. It's one of my favorite books. And one of the things that really caught my imagination when I was reading up about your book was injuries and the extent to which injury analysis and that kind of thing is quite interesting. I've heard Billy Beane in particular since Moneyball, he believes that injuries and the analysis of how players get injured might be the next development in terms of associating value to a player. What did you find out that was most interesting about injuries and the use of players and training and all this kind of thing?
Well, something I didn't really realize is the amount of games and the physical demands of the sport. Because, for example, Real Madrid started their season in August with the Super League, having won the Champions League the previous or this spring. And then they play La Liga matches. And then during the time, they also have international breaks that they then play for their countries. And then over the holidays, because they won the Champions League, they have to play for the FIFA World Club Cup, which is long, extensive travel, so they don't then get a winter break. Then they come back, and then they play, and they still have all these different tournaments. They have the Copa del Rey, they have the Champions League, they're playing La Liga matches. So all these, and then they have international breaks to then go try to qualify for the European Championships or the World Cup. So I really didn't realize how tired and physical the sport is for these players. And then I started analyzing something called the too tired effect, which means these players, they're emotionally and mentally and physically drained. They may actually not even show up as an injury. It's just that they're
fatigue or something.
Yeah, and obviously that increases age because they don't have time to rest. So as you find out later in life, the older you get, the harder it is to recover. So all of these things matter. What makes it unique for Real Madrid is that the way, the style of play that they have is very much a artistic, beautiful, improvised way of playing in many ways, in contrast to some teams that have very defined tiki-taka or whatever systems where you can sort of rotate players and they have very defined roles within a system. At Real Madrid, their fans expect this sort of artistic expression by these great players. So it's very difficult to rotate the players and maintain the same sort of level. So they're at some sort of disadvantage, in my opinion, because there's no defined role within the player. So they have to have familiarity with each other. So that places Real Madrid, in my opinion, at a competitive disadvantage over long periods of seasons where you need to rotate players.
I saw one excerpt from your book which talked about Ancelotti's use of some of the first team players, I think in the season after they won the Champions League, and how someone like Luka Modric was even perhaps misused and had a reoccurring injury because of he was just relied upon too much and played a bit too much.
Yeah, so I think if you look at the coaches who have been most successful at Real Madrid, they have tended to have been an elite player who won as a player, who won as a coach, and has a calm personality. And the reason it's important for them to be an elite player is because there are so many elite players on the team that there's some sort of unique relationship or respect that goes on. So Ancelotti very much had that, and I think was one of the reasons why he was so successful at Real Madrid, that plus the fact that he was a calm, calming presence. The one thing that Ancelotti, I think, did not completely embrace and fully grasp was the physical demands of the game and the rotations that are necessary. And I think there was also pressure from the community to always want to see the star players playing all the time because they paid for the tickets and they, when they come to the game, they want to see them, especially at home. So I think when Real Madrid went on their 20-some game winning streak and he kept playing the players again and again, by the time the end of the season came around, there was, you know, there was just fatigue, mental, emotional, physical fatigue, and that played out at the end of the season when you saw sort of a drop in performance. And you have to remember that you know, I put this statistic in the book, which is Ronaldo really has the ball or possesses the ball meaningfully for 60 seconds in a 90-minute game, and usually for 3 seconds at a time. So that means he's only going to have 20 really meaningful touches or possessions. And of those, there'll be 4 shots, and 2 of them will be on goal, and 1 of them will go in. That's sort of the statistical average. So on those 4 shots, if he doesn't get the ball at the right place at the right time, if he's off a half a step because he's a little bit tired from having played for his country, or he's just emotionally drained, or you know, he can't jump. He misses, you know, he jumps 6 inches less because his legs are just tired. He's going to miss. You know, he could hit the post as opposed to it going in. So it shows you how fragile the entire game really is. And so I think that's one of the things that happened to Ramjan. I think in the end, that was a frustration with Ancelotti. I think the other frustration was the fact that he did not incorporate the academy players, which is what I think helped lead to Benitez and Zidane, was familiarity with the academy and having the academy players. And you can see today that they play a much more prominent role, many more minutes. And the players themselves also play a leadership role within the club as well, because they've been around the longest. But I think that's another thing that Ancelotti didn't fully embrace.
You obviously spoke to the likes of Florentino Perez, the current president, and Butragueño, a club icon. What was it like to get so close to these figures who perhaps didn't mean much to you before you started the project, but you were probably certainly very aware of when you got through midway and towards the end of it?
Yes, at the beginning, I didn't know really much about Emilio Butragueño, who obviously was an incredible player. I didn't know much about Raul or the history of Real Madrid. I wasn't a fan of Real Madrid. But he was incredibly patient in terms of explaining everything, the history to me. And I also, I think, added to them because I did a lot of historical research to challenge many of the things that people would say in the media about Real Madrid's history. And so I think they actually got some things out of it as well. I think Florentino was very open and transparent and happy to spend time with me and answer questions. And I also think that, you know, he also learned because there was no one who was sitting around trying to go back into history and look at the actual data during the 55 to 60 time frame and things like that. People had sort of just accepted various things because they've been passed down by legend. So I think that they also enjoyed this sort of interaction. They do surveys to their fans to figure out which player they most admire in terms of values that are not on Real Madrid's team. So I thought that was very surprising because having read Moneyball, you would think that the first thing that they would look at was really the data analytics, but it was more about which players did fans want to be like. Because the whole thing is they want to put players on the pitch who, when you watch them, you say, that's who I want to be. I want to play like them. I want to look like them. I want to be them. I want to behave like them. So that's very much an important thing because that drives the passion by not just jersey sales, but it drives also the sponsors because of the loyalty and the passion. So there's that. And then the way the fans want or expect the players to play, so they expect this sort of improvised artistic way of playing. So I describe this as fans of Real Madrid believe that they have artists, which are the greatest players, with paint, which is the ball, on the pitch, which is the canvas. And they expect them for 90 minutes to create this beautiful artistic painting. And that's the way they want them to play. So whenever Real Madrid's coaches play players in a defensive way, and they don't sort of, play this beautiful attacking style, which they're accustomed to, that coach is not going to be successful for very long at Real Madrid. Because even if they win, the community doesn't like it. And the management team knows that. So all those things really play into how they manage the team, which includes the transparency to give all this data and information to me, to give to everybody, including competitors. Just shows that they know that their community values transparency and trust. So that's why they gave me the information.
The Real Madrid Way, How Values Created the Most Successful Sports Team on the Planet, is available now. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us on the show. It's been fascinating to talk to you.
Thank you very much for having me.
For more, head to the website, footballineurope.co.uk.
Well, it was great to chat to Stephen. Don't forget, this is a bonus show, and your regular Football in Europe podcast is out Tuesday, the 29th of November.
This is Football in Europe.